third in a series of three sessions where we've been talking about creation care and climate change. And I've self-titled this series, Scripture, Science, and Solutions. As with the past couple of sessions, we're going to start with a brief exploration of the Scripture. And then we'll move mostly today into talking about some of the specific solutions we have available to us right now to help solve the global climate crisis. Now, I imagine there are some people who haven't been with us from here last week, or maybe haven't been with us at all. So, who's new to this series? We've got a couple of people right here and a couple of people up here. Could I get some volunteers to fill them in, at least on what we talked about last week? I'm sure the rest of you were here. What did we talk about last week?
Sweden.
Okay, we talked about Sweden because Sweden is a good example of a country where they tried to reduce their climate, their global greenhouse gas emissions as a society, and they've been quite successful at it. And in the case of Sweden, I brought them up because they're a good example of what's possible if we actually focus our attention on the problem and work together to try and solve it. What did we, in addition to talking about Sweden, though, prior to that, what else did we talk about?
We talked about a multiplier effect.
Multiplier
is not the right word.
So we talked about, so in the first session we talked mostly about the changes that are taking place on the planet as a result of increasing concentration of this particular carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And we talked about the changes to the planet as first order effects. And in the next session, last time, we talked about second and third order effects where we were looking at, okay, what's happening to the planet and how's that going to affect people. And we had a regular exercise where you all are very informed and thought through some of the chains of consequences. For example, less snowpack resulting in less water in reservoirs, resulting in farmers having to perhaps water rationing, where farmers and drinking water for people and fish are in contention, and as a result, we have to start rationing water. We don't have the same crop yields. We end up having higher prices for food. So these are all the second and third order consequences of the changes that are taking place on the planet. And at the beginning of the session, we also talked in particular about who's going to be most affected. And we brought up the example of the fact that the majority of the people on this planet live on less than or equal to $8 a day. We here at Bellevue live on average on $187 per day. We're much more able to cope with some of the changes that are going to happen than the majority of the world's population. So today we're going to shift gears a little bit and talk about the impact, what's happening to the planet, the impact that's going to have on people, what people can do about the problem when they work together. Today we're going to move into talking more about what we individually and as households can do and the specific solutions that we have available right now that we can put to work. So with that in mind, I want to start with a couple of scripture readings. And today the focus of the scripture readings is really on what's our responsibility to act? How should we live? What does scripture have to say about that? Now I have just two verses I want to share, and I brought this today, so I'm equipped. And I actually even marked the places in it, so I think I can do this without any help today. So I want to start by reading a passage from Luke that everybody, I'm sure, is very familiar with, this parable of the Good Samaritan. And in this example, kind of think of the man beset by robbers as our planet for a moment. Just shift that switch and think about it from that perspective. And as we read this verse and the next one from James, I'd like you to ask yourself two questions. The first one is, well, is it possible to be a Christian and not be doing everything we can to reduce greenhouse gas pollution. The second question that I'd ask is, have you asked yourself this, what are the barriers that are preventing me from doing more to help reduce greenhouse gas pollution? And we'll talk a little bit amongst ourselves about those and share through. So starting with the word of the Lord from Luke chapter 10, verse 25. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. Teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? What is written in the law? He replied. How do you read it? He answered, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and all your mind. And love your neighbor as yourself. You have answered correctly, Jesus replied. Do this and you will live. But he wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, and who is my neighbor? In reply, Jesus said, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day, he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. Look after him, he said, and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have. Which of these 3 do you think was the neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? The expert in the law replied, the one who had mercy on him. Jesus told him to go and do likewise. The second passage I want to share before we talk amongst ourselves for a moment is from the letter of James, chapter 2, verse 3. Chapter 2, verse 14. What good is it, my brothers and sisters, if someone claims to have faith but has no deeds? Can such faith save them? Suppose a brother or sister is without clothes and daily food. If one of you says to them, go in peace, keep warm and well fed, but does nothing about their physical needs, what good is it? In the same way, faith by itself is not accompanied by action, is dead. So those are 2 scripture passages that I think have a lot of bearing on what we're going to talk about today. So with that, I'd like to have you just talk amongst yourselves for a couple of minutes about those 2 questions, and then I'd like to get a few volunteers to share the responses that their neighbors had to those questions. So let's take 3 minutes to do that. Thank you. So what I'd like to do is just get a few volunteers to answer some of the things that they thought are the biggest barriers to get in the way for them of doing more and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So who would like to volunteer what some of their neighbors said about this?
Time. Too many convenient ways to do stuff that's not
inconvenience was another one that we talked about.
What do you mean by time?
Donate time.
No, this is what gets in the way.
What gets in the way?
Physical.
Physical?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Meaning what specifically?
They're in one spot and they're in another. You can't get to where they're at.
Okay, help.
Help. You can't give them help because of where you're at and where they're at.
For reducing greenhouse gas pollution specifically?
Doing anything.
Okay. If you think about it in terms of reducing greenhouse gas pollution, what's getting in the way? Time, money, knowledge.
Do you might have job requirements that like my job requires me to travel all over Bellevue, so there's like little trips in my car, or like you might have to travel to a different state, you know, once a week or twice a month.
All right.
Back here.
Political will.
As in, not enough for stuff.
Well, I think to see that attitude, values and attitudes.
Of yourself or of other people?
Oh, yeah.
But is that, so that gets in your, how does that get in your way?
It affects your values, it affects your political will, it affects your motivation, your urgency of action.
Well, it's interesting. I haven't had anybody say money yet.
Yeah,
that's not a barrier. Well, it kind of covers a lot of things, doesn't it? There are a lot of things that get in the way. For the rest of this session, I want to start really focusing on the things we can do and things that we can do with the time and resources and the knowledge that we have. So with that in mind, I want to just say at the outset that if we're going to be able to leave a stable climate to future generations, we know what we need to try to do now, and we roughly know how to do it. So the goal that's been defined for us by the scientific community is that we have to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions globally 80% by 2050 if we hope to leave a stable climate for future generations. Not the climate we grew up with, but one that's inhabitable, one that's tolerable, one that's not miserable for people. Thinking about some of the second and third order effects that we talked about last time. So, if you think about the Sweden example for a minute, the how is what they've been doing. And there are really four pillars to a strategy for reducing our greenhouse gas emissions by that great an amount that we're going to have to implement to achieve that goal. The first is to be really, really efficient. And it's our buildings, it's our industry, it's our vehicles. Those are the big users of power in our economy. And again, thinking back to Sweden, for those of you who weren't here, they are twice as efficient per dollar of GDP. They use half as much energy as Americans do, as a country. And so they were working hard on the first one, being very efficient. The second thing that we have to do is we have to get fossil fuel generation out of the electrical grid. We need to generate electricity by other means than fossil fuels. And again, in the case of Sweden, they've accomplished that. They've got an electrical grid that's 98% fossil fuel free at this point. It's just rare, very rare for them to be burning fossil fuels to generate electricity. Then when you have a largely clean energy grid, you need to switch fuels. You need to, in other places like our vehicles, use electricity rather than gasoline. Or to heat our buildings, use electricity rather than natural gas. So fuel switching is another thing that we need to do. And then lastly, we have to do a much better job in our day of restoring some of the natural carbon sink mechanisms we have on this planet. Now, when I use that term carbon sink, do people understand what I mean by that?
No.
Okay, so there are a lot of in nature, there are a lot of examples where nature stores carbon that it takes out of the atmosphere. Plants, right? Trees, crops, grasses, they're all breathing in carbon dioxide and transforming that or using it as a fuel to make, in the case of trees, wood. So 50% of wood, by the way, is stored carbon that came out of the atmosphere. Hmm. Right? So there are a lot of mechanisms on this planet. It's a beautifully designed, very naturally balanced sort of system that we've disrupted because we've largely been taking stored carbon that was in the ground, taking it out of the ground, burning it, and then dumping it in the atmosphere, dumping the carbon dioxide that comes from the combustion into the atmosphere. So we have to reverse that process, and nature can help us do that. We're going to talk about that today as well. So there's some very good work that's been done in the Deep Decarbonization Pathways Project by teams of scientists and statisticians and economists around the globe who looked at individual countries and built simulations or models about what they need to do to achieve this goal. And they've mapped it out, and it tends to involve those four elements. Okay, Mark, you have a question?
Yeah, you mentioned, I think, first week that methane is actually a really big problem. Is there a natural carbon sink from methane?
Not specifically that I'm aware of. The best thing, so the example that Mark brought up was the fact that when we take natural gas out of the ground, and when we ship it, transport it, there's leakage. And that leakage could be large enough to make natural gas actually more polluting than coal. We just don't understand how much leaks at this point. Some of the work we've done suggests that it's pretty high.
Another example of to answer that question is that one of the other threats of climate change and global warming, if you will, is that there's a lot of methane captured in peat bogs, especially in the Northern Hemisphere. You look at Russia, the great extent of that geographic area is frozen permafrost. And as you can actually see the permafrost melting, it's releasing incredible volumes of methane.
So you brought up one example that I want to bring back to this. A natural carbon sink are bogs or swamps. And one of the things we do when we garden and use peat moss is to disrupt those bogs. There are vast tracts in Canada, for example, that are being mined, and a lot of that release happens. They dry it, compress it, ship it down to the United States where we bring it back out of its packaging, mix it with things, put it back in the packaging, and then it shows up in places like Home Depot or to commercial growers as something that we put into pots and plants it. So there are great solutions for things like that, and we're going to talk about them today. I'm going to move us forward, if you don't mind, because I don't want to run out of time for the really important stuff. One of the first solutions that I want to talk about is we're going to do a brief survey now, and I'm going to hit about 8 different solutions that are all really important if we're going to accomplish that pretty massive transformation that we just talked about of reducing greenhouse gas pollution by 80% by 2050. And the first one of these things is we have to put a price on pollution. We can't make pollution free, or people will consume too much of it, just like anything else. And the good news here is that we actually have a solution that's in Congress right now. It's got a bipartisan support, and it puts steadily rising fees on fossil fuels where they enter our economy. It collects those fees and rebates them back to households. So all of us get a check on a per capita basis in our households, which will go to offset the fact that, yes, some of those fees are going to get passed on to us in higher prices. Higher prices for natural gas and coal and oil that then gets turned into gasoline. So it's going to show up at the pump or in your utility bill. But the check will be offsetting that because all of the fees are coming back to us as citizens. The third part of the bill that's really important is that at the border, fees are going to get adjusted. So if you have a business that's competing with a business in another country that doesn't have fees on greenhouse gas pollution, we'll collect the money to make that neutral, level the playing field. My hope is that, and I think this is very likely to occur, other countries, when they see those fees being collected, are going to say, well, why don't we collect that money by putting in fees on greenhouse gas emissions here in our economy as well. So it would be one way for all those countries who want to be selling into the North American market, into the U.S. market, be giving them an incentive to actually do likewise. So this is a bill that's in Congress right now. 763? I think I added a digit there. I'm going to check the number. I think I added a digit to it. But you can look it up. You can read it. It's pretty straightforward. It's pretty clear. This is an essential part of it. It's not the only thing we need to do. It's an essential part of what we need to do to solve the global climate crisis. Do you have a question, Frank?
Yeah. So what's the what is the anticipated actual effect? Because if you're collecting fees on things,
right,
that anticipate that there's a rising price, but you're returning fees to the public in general to help absorb those prices, is there a psychological effect you're trying to induce here? Because it would seem to me that if you're paying people, they're going to level up their same consumption rate. Now they're just getting a check for a higher price.
So relative pricing, those are the things that matters. So if the cost of gasoline goes up relative to the cost of hydropower electricity, I'm going to purchase more hydropower electricity than gasoline. One of the ways I might do that is when I next go buy a car, I'm going to buy an electric vehicle, because this is just the case with me today. The fuel for my car is 1/6 the price of what I would have to pay to fuel the previous car I have. Right. So this is how it works in a global economy, capitalist economy. Price signals matter tremendously.
Right.
So
ideally, move over to electric cars, and then the money collected by gas car cars, gas fuels would start to go down, and the check would start to get smaller over time.
The one of the features of this kind of approach is that it goes away over time. When we accomplish the goal, the fees are gone, and they will be steadily dropping over time. So the expectation for this bill is that this by in and of itself has the potential to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions in the United States 40% by 2030. And this is a really big push in the right direction. So, in the interest of time, I'm going to keep going here. There's a fair number of these to talk about.
Jeff, you do have the right number,
763. 763. More energy efficient buildings. I am really impressed with what you have accomplished here. Is Kurt here today? I don't think I see him. Look at his charts. The amount of electricity used here has been dropping steadily over time, largely due to LED lighting, for example. But there have been a number of things you all have been doing here to keep the energy demand, as measured by the amount of electricity used, not natural gas, but that's a separate issue, but electricity used in your building, that's been going down over time. So you've been managing to this by measuring what is happening in your building. And I'm a big believer in that what gets measured gets managed. If you're not measuring what's happening, you're unlikely to do a very good job of managing it. So with our buildings, one of the things we have to do is start measuring and publishing that information. This has been happening in Europe for quite a while. Europe's more efficient in their buildings than America is, and that's, I think, one of the big factors. It's happening here now to a greater degree. There are a number of cities like Seattle, like New York City, who have put in benchmarking ordinances so that the amount of energy consumed by a building is something that's published. So people who are going to lease in a building or buy a building can know what the efficiency is of that building. The first place to do a good job of this in homes is Portland. And I participated in lobbying for and helped fund the implementation of the Home Energy Score policy in Portland. So when you go buy a house in Portland, you get a report. The report has a score. Think of it like a miles per gallon rating for your car. And that score was developed using an assessment, like someone comes into your home like an inspector does with most sales. They take a bunch of measurements, they run it through a model that spits out a calculation of what that home's energy efficiency is relative to other homes, and more importantly even, tells you a set of things you can do to improve the efficiency and how much your utilities bills might go up down as a result. So this is now something that you get by law when you go sell or purchase a home in Portland, in the city of Portland. First place in the United States that's done that. It's being done in other countries and places. So measuring is the important first step. Another really important thing, though, is financing. So has anybody heard of the term PACE before? So property-assessed clean energy loans are something that has been enabled, in particular in California, but now in 32 states. And several hundred cities where the lien actually goes on the tax bill. So it takes away this problem that we all have where we say, well, I don't
I've been in this house 5 years. Why do I want to spend $10,000 making it really energy efficient, putting in insulation, fixing leaks and things like that, when I'm just going to move on and I'm going to sell it? So it takes away some of that because you get the benefit and the ongoing cost of that implementation get passed on to the next owner. They get the benefit of the lower energy consumption. They also bear some of the cost because they're going to be living at home while that loan is still being paid down. So streamlining that process unleashed $5 billion of PACE lending in California over a 5 or 6 year period. Big chunk of that went to rooftop solar, went to energy efficiency work, some of them went to water efficiency work. So that's the kind of thing that we need that's an example of a solution that can help us. Another solution is just in new buildings, making them more energy efficient. This particular building design is now taking place in Quebec. And that building, relative to the code in that area, reduced energy consumption by 70%. That's really interesting features. It has a double wall sort of system with vents that can get open and closed based on sensors to sort of control the buildup of heat in the building in the summer. So it's a really interesting example of what we can do if we try, if we think about solving this problem. And the really great thing about all of these kinds of investments is that they reduce energy costs. They result in a cleaner electrical grid because we don't have to burn as much coal or natural gas. We can use more of the capacity of wind and hydro and solar for that purpose. They produce a lot of local jobs, which are really excellent living wage jobs. There's a lot of work that has to go into renovating our existing housing stock, for example. And you get clear air as a result. So these things tend to be all positive when you look at the overall implications of them. And we talked briefly, I think, previously about if you look out at Seattle or in Bellevue now, and you see these cranes, what's happening when a building is put in place, if it's built from concrete and steel and glass and aluminum and fiberglass, is it represents an enormous belch of carbon dioxide emissions when it's put up. And then, this is true for Seattle, not for Puget Sound Energy here, in Seattle, that same building, if it's electrified, if you use electricity to heat and cool it, its greenhouse gas emissions over its lifespan are minimal. So we have to do more to reduce the impact of those buildings. And in fact, when we build buildings, we can store carbon that might otherwise get released into the atmosphere. Has anyone heard of cross-laminated timber? Okay, you have here. Well, so briefly put, cross-laminated timber is a way to build big sections, a wall panel with window cutouts, floor panels, beams is quite a different thing, but these panels consist of layers of small caliber wood, like think 2x4s, at right angles to each other to a desired thickness. And then in a factory setting, they make other modifications so that piece can be just plopped in place and connected with steel connectors. In University of British Columbia, 2 summers ago, a building went up for over just 3 months that houses 400 students. It's the Brock Commons place. And that building is almost entirely timber. There's a small amount of concrete around the elevator shaft and in the foundation, and then there are steel connectors that bring all these other elements together. Buildings like that, and they've been put up in a lot more in Europe than they have here, have the potential to be roughly zero in their impact. The impact of the storage of carbon from the wood offsets the emissions associated with the concrete steel. So they're almost neutral in their impact at construction. And the difference between a typical U.S., think of a dormitory in the U.S. that got put up with mostly concrete and steel, as a design, the difference would be the equivalent of taking 3,300 cars off the road for a year. So it's a big number. And these buildings are attractive, and they perform well, and they're cost effective too. The first one, Mass Timber Building, is going to go up in Seattle in 2 years in the South Lake Union area. And the ordinances around the world actually are allowing a lot more of this kind of construction now. So this is an example of a solution. There's one other important factor that I mentioned. As we're putting 3 billion more people on this planet in the next 30 years, they all want great places to live and work. And the build-out associated with that is the equivalent of putting up an area size of Manhattan every month for the next 30 years. Okay, so that's how fast the world is building out. We don't see it here, because it's taking place in China, in Africa, and South America, places that we're just not familiar with how fast some of the urbanization is occurring. So this kind of change is really important and has a big impact. This one is probably more familiar to you because you're familiar with electric cars. But electric bikes are potentially an even bigger deal when you think about the majority of the population in the world that has $8 a day to live on. Right? So they may have a bike. Well, we can do a lot to transport ourselves around with bikes and cars that run on electricity in ways that will dramatically reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And does anyone else here have an electric car that they're driving around? Or have any other person? So recently, electric cars are now cheaper overall over the lifespan of the vehicle. They cost a little more up front, but they're cheaper to operate. And so when you look at the total lifespan of the vehicle, they are much less expensive already than internal combustion engine vehicles. So it's all good if you switch to an electric vehicle with one challenge, right? Range. And there are solutions for that as well, which we'll talk about in a moment. The other thing I want to mention is that we're shifting, in many cases in cities, to a model where people, they don't need a car. They just get transportation as a service. They just go tap on their phone, and some combination of a bike or a scooter or a transit or a car gets laid out for them, and they use that to get from point A to point B. And when you operate that way, most of our cars just sit around. They're not well-utilized assets. They may get used like 5% of the time. Most of the time, they're just parked. So when you have cars that are being used, different computer-controlled networks of vehicles moving around to the points where they know people are and the points where they need to go. Think of a Seahawks game, for example, and figure out how to most efficiently route along the way so that the fewest number of total miles need to be driven and everybody can get where they need to go. The efficiencies associated with that are potentially huge. One statistic that's kind of fascinating, if you took all the parking space in Los Angeles, the amount of property devoted to that is equivalent to 2 San Franciscos. So if you move away from everybody having a vehicle, the potential resource that gets freed up in land is tremendous. It could be a renaissance for our cities. So there's all sorts of good benefits that can come out of this much more efficient way of managing transportation. I want to mention biofuels because, there are a bunch of uses that are difficult, like heavy trucks or planes. We can create fuels from natural products. Right now, it's technically very feasible. It's not economically very viable right now, but that's largely because we don't charge for the pollution associated with the fossil fuels that go into these vehicles. If you implemented that tax, those products would become much more attractive. We'd figure out more efficient ways to create them, build up the scale to generate them at much larger volumes, and be able to substitute a lot more biofuels for fossil fuels.
What's the difference, traditional fuel versus biofuel, in terms of pollution?
Traditional fuel versus biofuel in terms of pollution.
So let's say like a
if you just think about taking wood waste products, for example, and using that to create ethanol and running some vehicles with it, it's a zero impact. So the wood takes it out of the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, we burn it again, so it goes back in the atmosphere, but it's cheap.
I can calculate it on a full life cycle basis.
I can't give you a very specific number, but you can certainly look it up. I mean, it depends a lot on whether you're using algae or waste animal fat or something, what exactly it is that you're using as your feedstock for the fuel creation process. The next thing I want to talk about briefly is what's been happening recently with the cost of unsubsidized new build generation of solar and wind compared to, in particular, gas and coal. So there's been a tremendous decline in the cost of generating solar and wind energy over the past 10 years, from hundreds of dollars per megawatt hour here to now in the range of, well, the numbers don't mean much to us because it's kind of hard to process them. The important thing is the fact that it's less than gas, and than running a power plant using gas or using coal. In fact, there are places recently where it's become more cost effective, meaning it would save you as a ratepayer money if there's a coal plant being run to generate electricity, it should be shut down, because the cost of building solar generation is less than the ongoing operating cost of the coal plant. So we're at a point just in the past couple of years where we will all benefit if we switch as quickly as we possibly can to these alternative forms of energy. Now, of course, you're in point, which is fair, that the sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow. And for that, we have batteries, which are going through the same kind of declines, maybe a little bit delayed. But if you look at one kind of battery, and there's multiple technologies. Lithium ion is the one that everybody's probably most familiar with because it's in your computers, it's in your car, and in phones. The battery pack prices, for example, cranked out by Tesla's factory in Nevada, have dropped from $1,000 per kilowatt hour in 2010 to now they're under $200, and they're going to drop to $100 in the next couple of years. And with that comes a whole bunch of things become possible that weren't possible before. Things like in a top picture, having solar farms that store energy during the day when there's excess production and use it at night. The vehicles themselves are getting better because the battery packs are the heavy, expensive part of the car. Those little electric engines are extremely efficient and they run forever and they require almost no maintenance. So the biggest technical hurdle with electric cars is the battery. And I've just gone through a second generation now of leasing a Leaf. First one was 2016, and in 2018, and my range went from about 75 practically, or 80 single charge to 130 or 40, so roughly double. And that's largely because they could squeeze more batteries into that car because we're figuring out how to make them smaller. And as an investor, I've learned about new things that are coming that are going to boost this even further. So, Mark, your question here.
Information on the impacts of the mining operations to get the minerals out of the soil?
Yeah, so there are precious metals in these technologies, which are, it's obviously not desirable to do an excessive amount of that, but relative to the impact of all the combustion of fossil fuels, it's a very manageable environmental problem or environmental challenge. One, for example, investment I'm looking at is a company that is developing a system for long duration storage. The problem with a lot of these kinds of batteries is they can't hold charge forever. And they dissipate their ability to hold charge over their lifespan. But with this particular technology, they convert zinc in solution into zinc metal when they put electricity into the electrochemical cell, the metal falls out, sits there, and then they reverse the process by bringing in oxygen, which interacts with the zinc in ways that generate a current. So it's all about moving ions from one place to another and generating current through that process. And that particular technology, we're looking at the data on it right now, is expected to be able to hold energy for days or even a month for $40 per kilowatt hour when it's mass produced. So there are really all sorts of things will change when we can store energy cheaply for long periods of time.
For truly long-term storage, how does the kinetic storage work with this?
So flywheels are an example of kinetic storage, right? So you spin up something when you've got extra energy, and then when there's you reverse the electrical poles on it, and when you let it wind down, it generates current when you need that energy back. Now, those tend to be good for short periods of time.
Gravitational storage?
I don't know anything about it.
You lift a heavy weight to a height.
Okay. So like pumped hydro, for example, is an example of, yes, there are other long duration storage technologies, but they're very limited in where you can do them. So things like, for example, pumped hydro, you can't just do it in the backyard. Not at a scale that's necessary. So moving to carbon 6 next, I want to talk about one for a moment that I've only recently become familiar with, and I'm really glad I learned about it. Because I garden, and I've long wondered why my garden does so poorly, and I think I've kind of figured it out now. Because I'm doing things in a traditional or a conventional way, I should say, not in a regenerative fashion. And what I mean by that is simply that a conventional agricultural system, the ground is tilled up, right? It's just turned over. There's no cover for it most of the year, except when the crop is growing, and then the crops that are growing tend to be a very simple rotation of just corn, wheat, and soybeans. So in that kind of a system, the results are that we're losing carbon dioxide out of the soil. Our soil is eroding, a lot of it's going away. You're dumping in a lot of chemicals to try and offset the fact that the natural capacity of the soil to support crops is weakening over time. So we put more chemicals in, which are made from oil for the most part. So fertilizers come from petrochemical plants. And we use more diesel fuel in order to till the soil regularly. So farmers in over the past 3-4 decades have been working on a different way to run their farms, which has a whole bunch of benefits. The way they tend to run this is that they have to do very little tilling, as little as possible. They keep cover crops on the soil at all times. And they use a complex rotation, or they mix 5 to 12 crops rather than just 3. And the result of that kind of a system is that they have much less erosion and lower intensity diesel fertilizers and pesticides as a result. And they start to rebuild the capacity of the soil by putting more natural carbon back into the soil. The impact of this, it's not big per acre, but there are a lot of acres. There's 300 million acres of crop lands in the United States in the lower 48, and that's about 7 times the area of Washington State. And when you do these kind of practices in over that huge acreage, you have the capacity to store millions of tons of carbon dioxide every year in ways that make farmers more profitable and restore badly eroded soils as well. So it's a win all the way around. We have the same challenge with our forest lands, where in an industrial forestry model, we tend to just grow one kind of tree, and when it gets to be 34 years old, the companies come in and they remove as much as they're legally allowed, right? And that results in areas around water, run which is hard on the environment. And it creates a situation where we get a lot more erosion of soil. We get a lot more weeds because everything else has been taken away. And they come in and get established, and then they're hard to get out. There are other models, more sustainable models that are promoted by organizations like the Forest Stewardship Council, that emphasize having more kinds of trees on any given land area, growing them longer before you harvest them, and also leaving more space around bodies of water. And the impact of those kinds of techniques for agroforestry are to store 30% more carbon in the soil than we would otherwise put in the industrial model. So those are two pretty big carbon sinks. We have about 500 million both private and public forest lands in the United States. It's even more than our croplands. So those are things that are here right now. We know how they work. We know the impacts they have. There are things that I'm just going to point out for a moment because there are many of them that are in stages where they are working at a small scale under ideal conditions. They need a lot more engineering to make them something that can scale commercially, but they are around the corner. They're not, you know, it's not, what do you call it, science fiction. These things are around the corner. They're hybrid plants, for example. I looked at an investment recently, you may know about this, involving some partner in it, Zunum Aero, that has a design for a small aircraft, 15 to 80 seats in that range, that can dramatically reduce operating costs, noise, and greenhouse gas emissions. Got battery packs in its wings that give it extra power for liftoff, and it has a gas engine that's usually that's very efficient for kind of cruising. And that kind of a plane has the potential not just to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but you might be able to get to point A from point A to B a lot faster. There are many regional airports that where if you want to get, for example, from like Pasadena to say San Jose, you may end up going through LAX and then SFO, and it's a pain to get from to the two places you really want to get to. It might be a lot more efficient to go through two regional airports, but that requires, you know, you can't be as noisy, and you have to be able to take off and land more quickly, which these planes can do. So that's one example of solutions around the corner. Really, we talk about wood buildings, and now what about really tall wood buildings? There are examples that are still in the conceptual engineering phase of buildings that could be 40, 50 stories high, made almost entirely out of wood. And, you know, for all the reasons we just talked about, that has the potential to have a dramatic impact on the greenhouse gas emissions associated with new buildings. Hyperloop transport, is anyone here familiar with the Hyperloop? The basic idea is that it's using a magnetic levitation system within a tube, so it's not affected by outside forces, and it has extremely low friction. And the practical result is that you will be able to go distances like LA to San Francisco in 35 minutes on 10% of the energy that you would if you use a plane, train, or automobile. These are in test stage, I can say, right now. And they've had tests where they've been able to run at 330 miles an hour, and they are working their way up to 700 miles an hour. So this is all coming. And it's not way, way out there. Another one is direct air capture. So think of this as kind of like the catalytic converter in your car. It scrubs the exhaust coming out of your car. Well, this system runs large volumes of air past some honeycomb matrices that on the walls of the little cells are impregnated with a chemical that wants to bond with carbon dioxide. So when the carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere passes these amines, they tend to be absorbed and bond with it, and then they flush them, with steam to move the carbon dioxide off to where they can collect it and use it for this picture is actually a plant that's in operation now in Switzerland on top of a waste incineration facility where they have excess heat that's not being used, just being emitted, and they can have use for it while they're using it to generate the steam. And then next door to the waste incineration plant is a greenhouse. And so they've got a 400-meter pipeline, and they move the carbon dioxide they collect over to the greenhouse, and they get higher yields on their tomatoes and on their cucumbers that they then sell into local markets. So, I mean, this is a small-scale version, but if you have a tax on greenhouse gas emissions, and you do start really investing in this kind of technology, who knows where it could go? We really don't know. So these are things that are around the corner. That was a lot to absorb, I realized, but I just wanted to give you a quick survey of the kinds of solutions that are out there, and then we're going to turn and talk more about what we can do right now in our everyday lives.
The civilian tax effect would be applied in four major areas where we focus our attention.
Yeah.
One was decarbonization of the electrical grid.
Yes.
And I kind of thought you'd have a slide. There is a current bill in the Washington legislation to do exactly that.
Yeah.
It sort of mirrors what the state of Hawaii has done, where they, several years ago, passed aggressive goals to decarbonize their electrical grid.
Yep.
Obviously, they're on an island, all of the fossil fuels.
You have to ship them there. It's very expensive.
There, and yeah. They've got tons of sunshine. They're actually ahead of the timeline to make that change.
Yep.
And utilities have come sort of full circle for being foot draggers and not.
Yeah.
Being active participants to being cheerleaders for making that change. So, Washington's able, or we're at a point where that's on the table. And I think we just need to interact with our legislature to say, yes, we think it's a good deal. It's certainly doable in Washington, and all the data we've got to get. The lowest percentage of our electricity from fossil fuels. And we have opportunities for wind and solar.
That's right. So we have a bill to make our grid over time 100% clean. And it's not a huge transformation for this region. It would be for some other regions, but for us, it's not that big a shift, frankly. So yeah, by all means, support the 100% clean electricity bill that's right now in the state legislature. So I want to just take a break for a moment and have you talk amongst yourselves about whether this changes. Are there any new insights or understanding that came out of this? You know all this already, and it doesn't have any change in your point of view. Or are there things you learned here that cause you to feel differently now about the potential to solve the global climate crisis? So let's take 3 minutes to do that.
Thank you.
And everybody come back to the center for a moment. And I just wanted to find out if this changed and how you feel about the potential to solve the global climate crisis. Was there anything, how do you feel compared to before some of what we were talking about? Does anyone want to share what they feel better now?
I'm hopeful.
Anyone else?
I just feel like there are some things that maybe we feel like we can change. I feel like if I could keep practicing and looking at and exploring new technologies and just keep on doing, that can happen. I feel a little bit more empowered, like I can make a difference.
Yeah, so the comment here was that I feel a little more empowered because I can see there are things that I can, I don't have to do all at once, right? But there are little things I can do that would take us in the right direction. And that's actually a really good segue to what I want to do next, which is, now many of you probably received a pointer to a calculator that you can use to do an estimate of your own household's carbon footprint. And did anyone have an opportunity to do that exercise? You did? That's great. You want to share anything you learned from it?
Well, I'm not sure because I looked at the electricity and natural gas, and I looked at my bills, for my annual consumption of both. And it says we're about half what the original thing was, And every month from the power company, I get something that says, you're using a little bit more than your neighbors.
Okay, well, I don't know what were, so there was some values put in this calculator that were representative of a four-person value household. So I wouldn't expect your numbers to be the same. You can just zero those out. Right? So when you copy it to your computer and use it, you should just eliminate those because they're not representative of your household. They were for a sample household. There was just, so there was something in there so people could see what it might look like for a sample household. But one of the things that I've, when we've done this before with people, and I can give an example of what the footprint is of a typical value household, people, by and large, just don't think about the impact of food, goods, and services. And yet, in a wealthy society, that may be the biggest source when you add those three things up. So when you look at, for example, a typical value household, and it's typical, a representative value household, with four people, $150,000 of income, 3,000 square foot home that was probably built before 1990, and two cars driving 12,000 miles a year. When you run the numbers on that household, it comes out to about 72 metric tons, remember those 30 foot spheres of carbon dioxide emissions per year, about 18 metric tons per person, which is very close to the average for the United States. So. And that particular household, this is how it worked out for them. I mean, transportation and housing are, of course, big, but food, goods, and services are also big, too. How can they do things is a lot harder. I mean, these things are a lot easier to calculate very precisely. So there's much work that needs to be done to better understand the impacts of goods and services. That said, I think this is probably representative. And so one of the things you can do is to start to get a handle on your emissions as a household. So just take a look at it, see where it's coming from, and then that'll allow you to focus your attention on things that you could maybe do to address some of these different slices of the pie. You have to shrink the whole thing. So there's a lot of work to be done here, but I think if you want to really be part of the solution to climate change, you've got to think about how you become carbon neutral. And so measurement is the first step. I've got to know what my impact is. It's an estimate, I understand. It might be even a guesstimate in some cases, but that's okay. It's part of it. You can refine it over time. So once you've estimated your household emissions, then you need to think about those changes you can make. We're going to look at a few in a moment. Saving energy, insulation and ceiling in your house, driving less, using more efficient vehicles, getting an electric car. Switching from gas and oil to electricity. The electric car is an example of doing that. Eating less meat and dairy and trying not to waste food and buying local wherever you can. Those are all examples of things that matter. In the goods area, it really is true that we have to figure out how to reduce, reuse, and recycle. How to specifically do that is very hard, I have to admit. I'm trying to figure out how we do that as a household. And you have to, it's just a mind shift that you have to make. For example, recently the gas grill that we had sort of cracked out and wasn't working, and I was looking at it with my dad, and we couldn't figure out what's wrong with it. It's old anyways, and we figured, oh, what the heck, I just need to replace it. And I said, wait a minute, this is a big thing of cast aluminum, right? There's a lot of greenhouse gas emissions associated with making this. Yeah, I could chuck it and get a new one, but why don't I just try replacing one of the parts? Thankfully, it was a Weber, I could get a part for it. I guessed kind of what part I needed. They sort of helped me figure it out. In the end, there was like a $50 part. And it took me a little more time than it would have to go down to Home Depot and buy a new one. But it was less expensive. And in the end, I didn't have to throw out this great big gas grill. So that's just a little anecdote. I mean, that doesn't add up to anything in particular, but when you start to think about that across everything you do, it can add up. And then in general, we have to figure out how to spend much more of our dollar on locally produced things rather than things that are getting shipped from the other side of the world to us. Now, you have to do all those things. You're not going to eliminate your impact. It's just not possible for us right now. Our system is so heavily invested in gas and oil and natural gas and coal that you couldn't eliminate all your emissions. But you can get a start on that, and then you can offset what you can't eliminate. And that's really the third step in becoming carbon neutral. So I want to talk about carbon offsetting for a moment, because this is probably not something, I'm going to guess for a moment, that this has not something that people have done before. Is that correct? Has anyone purchased carbon offsets?
Oh, great.
Okay.
PSC has a program.
So you've done it through PSC? So which one did you purchase?
There was a pilot program that they did at one point, and they offered something where it was like, I don't know if it was the direct kind of offer, but it was really solar
energy. All right, well, let's talk about them. That was more than I expected, but you know, it's not something that I have thought about until very recently. The pollution offsets are simply a way for you to go ask someone else to do something that will reduce greenhouse gas emissions on your behalf. And that could be your utility saying, stop using coal and natural gas, please go out and invest in solar and wind. It could be a farmer doing what we just talked about, switching to regenerative agriculture. These kind of projects are out there waiting for funding. And if we invest in them, we can do things that are going to legitimately take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Now, if you need to be thinking about how to make sure that, well, is it actually happening? So is it verifiable? Is the change going to be permanent? Is it something that wouldn't happen otherwise? It's kind of a complicated one in some cases. And then you have to hope that there's, you have to figure out whether there's going to be leakage. Are they going to go out? Is the farmer going to say, I'm going to switch my acreage here from in the conventional to regenerative practices, then I'm going to go somewhere else and do the same old thing instead. So there are things that are tricky about measuring this, but it's gotten much better recently. There are much better standards for this. So you as a consumer can rest assured, especially if you're going through an entity that's got a track record and some standing, that there's real benefit happening here. So a couple examples were mentioned, Green Power and Carbon Balance Program are through Puget Sound Energy, which probably most of us are required to use. The Bonneville Foundation is what I do to offset all my other greenhouse gas emissions. There's a new one now that's going to be coming out shortly, where for you can spend a dollar to take a metric ton of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere through carbon neutral credits in the NORI market. You're going to pay a farmer to do regenerative agriculture and help them make that transition. So these are all things that you can. This one will be ready in about 6 months, but these other three are ones that you can do now. And then there are more places you could go to shop for projects that you can invest in. And then some of them are starting to do it on your behalf. So if you go ride in a Lyft, they're going to offset that ride for you. The oil, the gas, the main associated with that, the emissions of that. The airlines in 2021, some of them are doing it now, but in 2021 they've agreed that they're going to do it across all the systems. They're going to start investing on your behalf in offsetting the emissions associated with your plane travels. So these are things you can do now and just put it into your household budget. Yeah, it's probably going to be hundreds of dollars a year for us, but that's not necessarily an insurmountable expense, and it will help us as households be neutral when it comes to the climate as we continue to work on doing things to reduce our impact. So I'm running a little over. I want to give us a few minutes to do a short exercise. At your tables, you should have a list of things you can do. And many of you may be doing some of these things already. So if you don't have one of these, please raise your hand and I'll get one to you. Does everyone have one at your table? And there are pencils as well. So what I'd like to have you do is just spend a few moments looking through that and think about whether this is something you'd be willing to do that you're not already doing. If you're doing it, check it off. That's great. If it doesn't apply to you for some reason, you can check that as well. Not applicable. But then indicate whether that this is something you'd be willing to consider doing. And we'll take a few minutes to fill those out in this talk. So I want to just close with a quote. First of all the faith traditions appreciate that we need to be taking care of creation. And there's almost all of them, I could think of, have made official pronouncements to that effect. One that I'm familiar with from the Presbyterian Church had this to say: as our planet grows warmer, our Christian witness must become bolder. As individuals, families, congregations, and church administrative bodies, we must become the change we want to see in our nation. We must put our own conscience in order, even as we call on the nation to accept its moral responsibility with regard to energy policy and climate change. Together, we must radically reduce our carbon footprint. So that came out of a piece to the Presbyterian Church. I was just curious, you know, when you think that came out. Does anybody have any?
Decades ago. Probably 70s.
Yeah, not that far. But 2006. This was 2006. Calls to action. And there are others like these. There were a whole bunch of them in most of the faith traditions in the 90s when they started to realize how much impact people are having on the planet. So much time has transpired since then. We really haven't changed very much. So, you know, my appeal to you is to think about how you can change. And this list of things that I provided for you are not exhaustive by any means, but it should give you the sense that there's a lot you can do. And we all need to do it sooner rather than later if we really want to pass a stable climate on the future generations. So that's my request of you, is to take that challenge on and see what you can do. Go carbon neutral now, because I know you can do that tomorrow. All you have to do is measure your impact, offset what you can, or reduce what you can, which may not be very much right now. More over time, and then offset the rest. And by doing that, you'll be sending a signal that will be heard by many people and build more momentum around the change that you need to pass to the climate of future generations. So thank you for sticking with this. And I know going past it, you might need to get on to the 11 o'clock service.